Hello and welcome once again to the Best Anchor Stocks podcast. It's an exciting one today. I had the pleasure of talking with Christian Billinger, CEO of Billinger for Valtning, about the spirits industry. I think it's a very timely podcast, and we talk about all of the topics that matter for the industry, including the challenges that it's currently facing. I would recommend listening to my previous podcast with Christian, where we talked about different boring industries, spirits being one of them. And I also recommend checking out the article I wrote on the industry, which you can find in the show notes. But before getting started, let's hear about today's sponsor, Public.com. Are you paying too much to trade options? If you're not trading on Public.com, the answer is yes. Public is the only platform where you earn a rebate on every option contract traded. And that's in addition to no commissions or per contract fees. There's no one else out there paying trading rebates, so you won't find a better deal. Bottom line, if you're paying more than $0 to place an options trade, then you're paying too much. Switch to Public and start getting rebates on every single contract traded, only at public.com. Paid for by Public Investing. Options not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures in podcast description. So welcome again, Christian, to the podcast. It's actually you're the only guest that has come twice now to the podcast. I mean, I have like 10 episodes and it's your second time here. I 100% recommend listening to our previous conversation where we touched on boring industries, boring quote unquote, obviously.
Yeah.
Today it's no different because we're going to dive deeper into one of those industries, which is the spirits industry. So thank you very much for coming, Christian.
Thank you. So it's a great honor to be back. And actually, I don't think it's that boring. I think it's a pretty interesting industry to look at, although I'm sure you mean in terms of the sort of financial dynamics of it. But thanks for having me again.
Okay. So I think we should start maybe making a distinction that not many people make when talking about the industry, right? Because a lot of people view spirits as synonymous with the total beverage alcohol industry. But they are actually not the same. So would you mind telling us which are the difference between the TBA industry and the spirits industry?
Yeah, that's a good place to start. So broadly speaking, TBA, which is total beverage alcohol, is, you could say, it's mainly spirits, beer, and wine. And then in addition, you have some smaller categories, depending on your definition. Some people include low and no alcohol in that, both beer and spirits. You would include ready to drink in that. And that's been it's a small but a rapidly sort of growing category. And so clearly by volume, beer accounts for, well, if you look at the overall market, it's one of the things that strikes me is it's an enormous market, right? Even if you compare it to other categories of consumer goods. So I'd say you're approaching the 2 trillion now, to the extent you want to sort of rely on, or you have the confidence in the data we have on this. But I think the best guess we can make is that it's a market approaching 1.8 trillion or so, I think, US dollars. I think something like 80% of the volume is beer. But in terms of the value, it's a much different picture. So spirits, I think, is something like 40% of that. Beer is maybe 35% of that. And then you have wine at say 20%. And then the remainder, so say 5% or so, would be the RTDs and the low and no alcohol, et cetera. But of course, that split will vary significantly by market, right? So if you look at, you know, some emerging markets, if you look at India or China, for instance, spirits would account for a larger share of that perhaps. And then in some European markets like Germany, beer might account for a higher share, but that's probably a good place to start in terms of TBA and the components.
Mm-hmm. And I think if we talk about, let's say, Lindy or Lindy Industries, I think spirits probably comes to the top, right? Because spirits have been with humans for many centuries. So I don't know if you could give us some introduction to the history of spirits and also maybe the roadblocks or the bumps that the industry has faced, right? Because it has been with us for a long time, but it has not been a smooth ride, especially in some geographies.
Yeah. So I think from the point of view of an investor, clearly it's a very old phenomenon, right? We're talking, certainly in terms of alcoholic beverages, we're talking thousands of years, if not more than 10,000 years of sort of established history there. And I think in terms of distilled spirits, that's slightly more recent, but we're probably talking at least 1,000 years of recorded history, right? If you look at the categories that we are mainly concerned with when we look at the large listed companies, so take cognac and scotch, et cetera, you'd probably go back at least 500 years. And if you look at, these are of course very sort of rough numbers, but if you look at the brands, and this is, I think, where it gets really interesting from an investor's, and especially a long-term investor's point of view, the durability of these brands, because if you look at the major cognac brands, for instance, you know, these would be early 18th century. So we're talking 300 years of track record or history here. And similarly, of course, for many of the Scotch brands, they have a very long history. And I agree with you. I think that's one of the key attractions when you look at a business like this, because of course they're time tested. And it also means that even we'll get to the challenges these companies are facing today, but in some ways we've been there before several times, right? These companies have seen ups and downs before. And in fact, the entire industry has experienced these ups and downs, and people have questioned at times in the past, have questioned, you know, what about the health lobby, and what about, is there a structural decline in consumption, et cetera? So I think that long track record, one, shows the durability of the categories and the brands, and two, shows that, you know, this is a product and a business and an industry that is able to sort of withstand a lot of challenge and pressure. And in terms of the challenges you mentioned, you know, the industry has faced historically, I tend to think of them as mainly related to regulation on the one hand, and consumer behavior on the other. Now, there's a third aspect, which is more company specific, and that's to do with the governance of these businesses. But we'll get back to that perhaps later. But in terms of regulation, of course, that can come in various shapes. You know, most famously, people would look at prohibition and the impact that had, or rather didn't have, in the industry in the US. And I think it is an interesting case study. But of course, you're going back 100 years in time. And so there's a lot of things have changed. But I still think that's probably an instructive period to look at. But other aspects of regulation that are relevant would be things like, you know, a dry state. If you look at United Spirits, which is part of Diageo, if you look at their Indian business, which is potentially an incredible business. But of course, regulation in India is very difficult state by state. It's very complex, I should say. And of course, a very large number of states in India are still what are called dry states, right? So that's one other aspect of regulation. Tariffs is a third one. Alcohol duties is another one. I would even include things like drinking guidelines here, right? Even if they're not regulatory as such, but I think they do possibly impact consumer behavior. So there's a number of things to consider on the regulatory or sort of public policy side. And then on the other hand, you have consumer behavior. And this is an industry that is characterized by very long cycles, right? So when you speak to executives in this industry, they always say that the cycles in this industry are generational. Most consumers don't want to drink what their parents drank. Possibly that's true. I think there's some evidence to say that's true. But of course, you also have questions like, are young consumers drinking less today? And will that gradually have an impact on the sort of underlying growth rates for the industry? I would probably argue that most of the challenges we're discussing, you know, facing the industry today, in some shape or form, they've seen them before, whether it's to do with structurally lower consumption rates or category shifts or, you know, the increasing emphasis on health and wellness. Now, that's not to say that they're not relevant. You know, I think it's important to consider that much of this isn't necessarily new.
And I would go, I think, as far as to say that we'll talk later about this, but in some industries, at the end, the excessive, let's say, well, not excessive, but the higher regulation has been a challenge, but also an opportunity for established businesses to strengthen their competitive advantages, right? Because the entry barriers were much higher. But we'll go later on into this. I think it's better if we first focus on the growth trends of the industry, right? And as you said, people are worried about structural consumption being lower. But I think it's also important to explain that these industries are not 100% reliant on volume, right? And I think what you said at the beginning is also a good hint, right? Because spirits doesn't make up the most volume, but it does make up the most value. So let's talk about the growth trends. And we can start with, for example, spirits taking a share of beer and wine, which I think is the clearer one.
Yeah. So I think if you look at the US, which is the largest, certainly the biggest profit pool for these companies, if you look over the last 10 or 15 years, that's clearly been the case, right? So in fact, if you look at the US market, per capita consumption has increased, but that's a somewhat different topic, but I think still important to keep in mind, given everything we hear about people drinking less, which turns out isn't necessarily true. But anyway, spirits has been taking share from beer and wine. I think that's clear from the data. Now, there are a few different possible sort of explanations for that. I think the health and wellness, sort of the awareness or the emphasis on health and wellness among especially younger consumers, I think is potentially, and I say potentially because it's very hard to, you know, have sort of a definite answer to what the causes are, but I think that's clearly a possible explanation, right? If you look at lower calorie options, et cetera, drinking less, but better, as the industry would say. I think the other big potential driver there has been the, you know, increased participation. Now, this is over decades rather, but by females in the workforce and the fact that they account for a larger proportion of total consumption today. And historically and typically they preferred, and I think still prefer, spirits and wine over beer. So mm-hmm. I think certainly in developed markets like the US, you've seen this phenomenon. It may look slight, as in the phenomenon of spirits taking share. It may look slightly different in other parts of the world, especially in emerging markets. But yes, I think the industry itself always emphasizes that should continue to be a growth driver for these companies.
Mm-hmm. And I think an interesting growth driver, which also might be seen as a challenge, right, is low to no alcohol and ready to drink, right? These are two relatively new categories. And for people who don't know, ready to drink is basically you get the cocktail in a can, right? So you don't have to mix it yourself. Yeah. And you basically open it and you drink it. It can be Coca-Cola with Jack Daniels or with whatever other spirit. And low to no alcohol, it's self-explanatory, right? We've seen companies like Diageo come out with Guinness, no alcohol, Tanqueray, no alcohol. So the industry is also going to low alcohol drinks. And one of the things that I believe, right, is alcohol gets taxed quite heavily in many geographies. Yeah. So when these companies release no alcohol drinks, then the taxation is different, right? And my experience has been that when I have had Tanqueray no alcohol, the price was the same or a bit more expensive. Yeah. But at the same time, taxation probably is going to be much more favorable to those drinks. So how do you see these two categories playing out? Because I mean, they're going to be important for the industry.
Yeah. So they're very fast growing, of course, but they're also very small today. And so for the foreseeable future, although the industry likes to spend a lot of time on this, but I think the brewers, you know, and especially some of the brewers, I think emphasize this more. So Heineken, for instance, who are the clear market leader in low and no alcohol beer and who've been very successful with 0.0 and other products. I think if you combine low and once again, to the extent we can sort of rely on the official data on this, but if you combine ready to drink and a low no alcohol beer, we're still probably talking about less than 5% or say 4% of the total market. So that it will take a long time for these categories or types of products to, you know, make a meaningful difference to overall industry growth rates, right? I think what it could do is, I think it's helpful from a sort of PR, call it ESG point of view, if, you know, to the extent we should worry about those aspects, right? Because it's actually an opportunity for the industry to say, we're doing something, or we're enabling consumers to make a responsible or sensible choice here. So I think to me, that's probably the more important aspects of it for now. In the long term, it may very well become meaningful. And just a final point on what you said about, you know, this may very well be a more profitable category for the for these companies. Potentially, I think the price ladder is less interesting. So you can, you know, you will see less price, I'm relatively confident, stretch here in terms of the interval between low and high priced than you will in traditional categories or segments of the market. And also, I think there's always a concern that customers or consumers feel somewhat ripped off here, right? Because they're, you know, what am I paying for, right? And maybe that's more obvious to people like you and me and people listening to this because we spent time thinking about it. But I think that's something that needs to be managed by these companies, that sort of reputational side of things.
One of the things that I would say that the alcohol industry has done well, and you mentioned it there, is that maybe when you look at tobacco companies, a lot, let's say, waited until the very end to start being socially responsible, and maybe when it was already a bit too late to not face regulatory backlash. And I think the spirits industry has learned probably the lesson there and are more or less focused in trying to avoid that and trying to get less negative publicity while their respected businesses, right? Because the end, and more so today, right? Because you have social media and everything spreads like super fast. So you have to be very careful with your message. This is maybe not a growth driver, but I think it's how many companies in the industry have grown over time, which is consolidation. We have several large groups. The two largest are Diageo and Pernod Ricard. And they've been buying over the years these smaller brands and then scaling them. Do you think that's going to continue? Or do you think that something has changed in the M&A landscape that is going to be to make that growth driver much more challenging in the future?
So if you look at the spirits companies, you know, over 10 or 20 years at least, clearly there's been consolidation there. If you look at the way Diageo has been sort of put together, and but it's still a much more fragmented market than brewing. So if you look at the brewers, I think the top four globally, once again, take the data for what it is. But if you look at the global picture, the top four brewers control something like 50% of the market and much more of the profit pool, right? So that's a highly concentrated market. Whereas if you look at the distillers, that number is about half. So I think the top four control something like 25% of that market. So there's, I think big picture is that there's still much more fragmentation in spirits. You could argue that that's just the nature of the industry because brewing is more about not necessarily barriers to entry, but you know, what you would probably call barriers to scale, right? So, and scale is much more important there because it's more about, you know, you're running these long sort of production series and it's about getting low unit cost, and it's about efficient logistics and all these things. So I think to some extent, brewing is by its very nature, you know, the logic there calls for a higher concentration, right? I think if you look at the kind of acquisitions you refer to, adding attractive but potentially undermanaged brands, we've seen some, you know, some of the greatest success stories in European alcoholic beverages have happened through that. So if you look at Aperol, I think it's possibly the best example, right? When Campari acquired Aperol 20 years ago, that was clearly a very good brand, but it wasn't managed as well as it could be. And so they've internationalized the business and it's been an incredible success. I'd love to see more of that. And you do see these companies, if you look at clearly in the case of Diageo, they've been quite active in recent years acquiring tequila, AA gin, you know, Kopi liqueur, various things, right? If you look at Campari, they've also been adding bits to their portfolio. Remy to some extent, but less so. They're a much more focused business. I think one of the real challenges there, Leandro, is that many of these, you know, it's an industry where you have an awful lot of family controlled companies, right? And that's true even if you look at the large listed groups. So if you exclude Diageo, but you look at Pernod, you look at Brown-Forman, you look at Campari, you look at Remy, right? They all have significant family in influence or control. So equally, when they're looking to acquire businesses, of course, often that's what they're facing, as in, And I think especially now where valuations are, you could argue on the one hand, this, you know, this could be a great opportunity for a wave of consolidation. But the issue is that many of these families will be, unless they're forced to, I think will be unwilling to sell at the valuations that are currently sort of, you know, floated in market. So the challenge, I'd like to see more, but I think there are real obstacles on the way there.
But I think it's interesting in the M&A industry, in spirits, it's interesting because in M&A in other industries, you'll see the acquirer tell you that they are buying the business and they're going to grow it much faster. And that you can be skeptical about that. Yeah. But in spirits, I would say if a big group acquires a smaller company, you can be 100% certain that they're going to scale it up because they have the means to do so. And the small brands don't have the means, for example, to, like Diageo is going to do right now. They're going to take tequila and they're going to bring it globally. I mean, not many companies can do that sort of distribution. So
no, I agree. Tequila is a good example because, as you said, it's clearly US category today. You know, the next, and it's been, growth rates have been astonishing in the US, but of course they've come down significantly. And now I think the next sort of leg could be international, growing this internationally. We'll have to see how that goes. I agree with you. The only concern I have is when you look at some of the majors, my concern is that they're a bit too willing to accelerate growth in a way that makes it unsustainable. So I'm not sure if that's what happened with Casamigos, but clearly Casamigos was, you know, flying, right? You know, for a number of years, even when it became a somewhat meaningful business, it was growing at 50 to 100%. And now it's gone into reverse. And we've seen this with a few other acquisitions they've made. I'm not necessarily saying that they're mismanaged, but I worry that they don't always spend as much time worrying about the sort of sustainable growth of these businesses as they should do.
No, I think it's a fair concern. I mean, what you've seen with Casamigos, they've grown it super fast. Now it's gone south and now they're refocusing on Don Julio, right? Because it's much more premium and it's a much more durable business probably.
Agreed. So and that could be to do with the price points, you know, which price points are doing better in that category, et cetera. So that's why I'm not saying it's not necessarily mismanagement, but I do sometimes see that, you know, especially companies like Diageo, which there's no, you know, unlike some of the other family control groups, there's no one person that will sort of set out the long-term vision and direction of the business necessarily. And so I think there's always a risk that, you know, they're more concerned about the medium-term sort of financial delivery, but I'm sure we'll get back to that.
Mm-hmm. And I think a very interesting topic in the industry, and one topic probably that makes the industry very interesting, is the inherent competitive barriers that you can find in the industry, right? When I started researching the industry, as an outsider, I thought that the brand was the most significant competitive advantage. Then I started analyzing the industry. And while I still believe it's important, I think distribution probably is more important competitive advantages, especially in places like the US, right? Where you have the three-tier system that you need the contact with the distributors and everything, and you cannot sell directly to the consumer.
Yeah.
And then you also have competitive advantages like location or aging the liquid. How would you categorize these competitive advantages? So which one do you think it's tough to categorize them like in positions, but what do you think is the most important competitive advantage of the industry?
Yeah, I agree. I think you, on the one hand, I would argue you would look at categories where you have a combination of, you know, protected geographic origin, right? Aging requirements. And in some cases, cognac, I think, is the best example of all of these, where you also have very restricted or constrained access to raw materials, right? Scotch is similar in many regards, but I think it's slightly different when it comes to the access to the raw material or the input. But so these are categories which have historically been considered to have very high barriers to entry. And I think they still do. Having said that, I think one good example of an exception to that is what has happened in the cognac category in the US, right, over the last 10 years, where we have one challenger brand, which is Douze, which has gone from, I think, less than 1% of the market to 10% of the market now in a decade. And all the major, I mean, historically, this is a category that has been dominated by the big four. But in the US, and now we'll have to see if it's sustainable, right? Some people would argue that all these celebrity endorsed brands, is an example of that, that, you know, their shelf life is only as good as that of the celebrity that's the sort of sponsor or the backer, mm-hmm. the promoter. So we'll have to see. But I think it's still an important lesson, or it's an important wake-up call, because these are categories which, you know, people thought were almost impenetrable, but it turns out they weren't necessarily. But I would still argue those are categories where you have much higher barriers to entry and where you see much more stable competitive dynamics. If you look at market share dynamics in cognac or scotch, certainly in the Western world, in, you know, the last 5, 10, 15 years, they're quite stable. At the other end of that spectrum, you would have categories like gin and vodka. Vodka may be the best example, where you have, you know, there's no sort of protected geographic origin. There are no aging requirements. There are no restrictions effectively in terms of access to the raw materials. So I think there, barriers to entry are clearly lower. And you see that, generally speaking, you see that in terms of higher fragmentation. You know,
probably the only thing that they have positive over the other categories is that they don't have to necessarily face import tariffs, right? Because you can manufacture vodka in the country, but that's probably much it, right? Because anyone can compete with you in tequila, in gin, or in vodka.
Yeah, no, I agree. Certainly in terms of the regulatory risk, that probably puts them in a better position. But that tends to be more of a sort of cyclical phenomenon, doesn't it? So I think structurally, it still seems to me that, you know, some brown spirits, cognac, scotch, are sort of inherently should be, at least. Now, they aren't always managed or executed as well as they could be, but they should be inherently more attractive categories. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, you know, vodka, gin. Having said that, you know, vodka, I mean, Tito's is the best example of this. You know, that's been an incredible success, right? You look at the last 5-10 years of growth in that business. Obviously, that would have been a much better place to be invested if we were able to, than something like a Remy or a Diageo. Or so I think, you know, it's important to be aware of these differences in terms of moats and barriers to entry. But I don't necessarily think that means they're always better places to invest, right? So if you find the right, you know, if you find the right sort of person to back, but they're few and far between, I would argue, those success stories, and they're very difficult to spot before the event. So I think generally that's a sort of helpful way to think about barriers to entry here.
And I think one of the maybe more controversial topics that right now in the industry is marketing, right? Because some years ago, when there was no social media, only a few companies had the money to advertise mass scale, right? Obviously, with the arrival of social media, all the celebrities, the influencers, then more brands, smaller brands, are having access to cheap marketing. Then you have the big guys that say that this is not a disadvantage for them because they have more data and they can cater better to the end user now than they could some years ago. So their marketing spend is more efficient. Where do you stand in between those two arguments? Do you think that marketing, like the access to social media, has diminished the marketing moat? Or do you think that the big guys will continue to thrive with the marketing spend?
Yeah, I think it's a very important question. I think intuitively, the argument makes sense, doesn't it? That we've lowered the barriers here because it's now easy, you know, access to marketing and to some extent distribution channels is more sort of democratic. When I look at the market share data, on the whole, that doesn't seem to be the case to me. So if I look at the market share that goes to the independents, so these are companies that would, you know, individually would represent less than 0.1 of a percent of the market, I think that's the cutoff. In most categories, there's been no clear increase in the share of the market that goes to these small independent players. In many cases, they've been in decline over the last 5 or 10 years. There are some exceptions to that. So if you look at gin, for instance, in many markets, right? So this sort of relates to the previous barriers to entry. I think you've seen it in the case of gin, you've seen with vodka in many markets. And clearly, if you look at tequila in the US and the celebrity, I think celebrity endorsement is really where this becomes very relevant. What you're saying about sort of social access to social media and direct marketing, etc. But I think you have some categories where it's true, but in many ways, they are the same categories where barriers were always lower, right? So I think for the categories that, you know, we would still like to believe have higher barriers, I think there you've seen much less of an impact. I'm not saying you haven't seen any, because clearly we mentioned cognac in the US being one exception, but I think on the whole, that's not been the case. And certainly if I compare spirits to other, you know, consumer, fast-moving consumer goods categories like cosmetics, I think the impact has been much less. In some markets, we also need to consider that marketing is highly sort of regulated, or so in some parts of Europe, for instance, you effectively cannot market these products, right? And the distribution system, we also touched on, say, a three-tier distribution in the US means that I think having access to social media is only part of the equation. So I think on balance, my conclusion is yes, in some categories, it's had some impact, but on the whole, I don't think it's nearly as dramatic as most people might think.
I think one of the conclusions that this led me to is to believe that instead of being competitors, these smaller brands that were growing through social media at the end were, let's say, growing into potential acquisition targets, right? Because that's what we've seen happen. We've seen, well, Casamigos is an example, right? Because it started with George Clooney, then Aviation Gin came from, So you have businesses that are investing in their marketing, but there's only a point to which they can scale, right? Without the, like you said, the distribution network. And even in some cases, because maybe they don't have access to more liquid, right? If you are trying to grow a cognac business, you know much more about cognac than I do, but I remember reading that around 80% of the volume is controlled by the big four or something like that. Obviously, there's not much place to get the liquid from.
Yeah, no, and also in cognac, you know, they clearly you can get access to the raw material because Doucet, if that's the pronunciation, have done it. But historically, that is an industry where the big four players have had very sort of long standing supply agreements with, right, to actually source the grapes or the eau de vie, rather. So, yeah, so I think in a way you come back to, you know, in a way, it's just another way of expressing what we discussed when we discussed moats or barriers to entry, right? Clearly, if barriers to entry are lower, then, you know, getting access to, say, social media or new ways of marketing these products means that, you know, you'll probably have a higher number of small independent players coming into the market. Now, some of those will be winners, right? In the case of Tito's or clearly in tequila, there's a number of very successful examples. But I think the difficulty there as an investor in medium to large size listed companies, which we are, right, is spotting them and getting exposure to them at an early stage. So I think for that reason, I prefer those categories which have more stable competitive dynamics. If I could get exposure to some of these smaller, fast growing players in, you know, say gin or vodka, that may be interesting, but I think that's also more of a game for industry insiders, I think, right? That's a much more active way of investing, people who go on boards and, right, that kind of mode of operating.
And probably another topic in the industry is that of brand loyalty. And this is not a topic that's been surfaced by investors, right? I mean, these companies, Pernod, Diageo, they are saying that brand loyalty might be decreasing with respect to prior generations. Yeah. So, well, the reason obviously is that younger people are more open to trying new things. What do you think probably is going to be, actually, now that I think about it, a very similar answer to what we've just discussed, right? Yeah. So probably we can even omit the question because brand loyalty probably is going down, but there are more moats in the industry than the brand. And this is the reason why I think that the brand is not the most competitive, like the most important competitive advantage, right? Because it might be not as strong today than it was back then. Certainly in some categories it is, but maybe it's not because those categories are special, but because not many competitors can go into those categories. Yeah. So then you don't have brand.
I think that may be true, but for whatever reason, clearly in some categories, once again, as you said, it could partly be because there are fewer brands. If you look at cognac, there are fewer brands to choose from. And in some ways the answer, you know, this goes back to the earlier conversation we had about malts and everything. But if you look at the actual, if you take a different approach and you look at the actual stability of market shares, you look at, once again, the categories that would be considered to be sort of more predictable, Scotch or Connet, there, I think there is more brand loyalty. And you haven't seen much variation, generally speaking, or nearly as much variation in terms of market share. Of course, in other categories, you know, gin vodka again, you have seen much more volatility. And I agree with you. This is not something that the industry, an issue that the industry pretends isn't there. I think they're very open about it. But actually, the data suggests that market shares in some categories are still very sticky and stable. And just one more point on that, it would be that, of course, what the companies can do is to diversify their portfolio. So if you look at Pernod and Diageo, you know, that's what they have done. So they would tend to have a growth relay, so to speak, of brands and categories. So if you go back 7 years, let's say, I don't think anyone expected tequila to become one of the most sort of important growth drivers for the group, because it was a very small part of the business and growth rates were, I can't remember what they were at the time, but they were certainly not what we've seen going back 2 or 3 years, right? So out of nowhere, almost, tequila became a key sort of driver of growth at the group level for Diageo. And so I think the fact that, you know, yes, younger consumers may be switching brands and categories more, but one way to address that as a CEO and as an investor is to get exposure to companies either that are highly diversified or to own a basket of these companies, you know, depending on personal preference.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, this argument is interesting because a lot of people are claiming that spirits might be losing some of the inherent barriers to the industry. And that might be converting these companies into more of our normal beverage company, like can be Coca-Cola or Pepsi. I know that they have more things, especially Pepsi has food also. But at the same time, when I hear that argument, I think, well, I mean, these are not bad businesses, right? There must be some wider competitive advantage to just selling alcohol, because these businesses have like grown throughout a long period. And obviously they've done great.
Yeah, I agree. I would say if I compare to the European indices, I mean, the large list of spirits groups and even the mid-cap groups have significantly outperformed over long periods of time. And they've significantly, in the case of Campari, for instance, you know, since IPO, it's an astounding performance, right? So, you know, if we look at the last 18 months, 24 months, it's been pretty horrid, but over long periods of time, these have been incredible businesses, right? I think the parallel to the carbonated soft drinks is interesting, because I think there you may perceive lower barriers to entry, but very significant barriers to scale. And once again, I think that resembles more of what you see in some categories. So once again, I don't want to call them the lower end categories, but if you look at gin and vodka, and clearly if you look at brewing, I think the parallels are clearer. If you look at categories that operate more of they don't operate what looks like a luxury model, but something that more resembles that in some respects, especially if you look at Remy, I think you're moving further away from that. So I think for parts of the portfolio, there's more of an overlap. Clearly, it's in some categories like mixers, there's a very clear, that you could see a clear sort of adjacency between these two, you know, between the sort of soft drinks companies and the spirits or groups or the brewers. And I think we are seeing early attempts by some of the soft drinks groups, and I think some private label players to actually move into, you know, spirits branded soft drinks, so to speak. So clearly there are attempts to converge, but I think for parts of the portfolio that may become relevant. I think for other, you know, categories, I think they will probably remain two very different cultures and ways of operating a business.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be the guy who talks about risk-adjusted returns while we are at all-time highs. But if you look at history, these companies probably have outperformed on a return basis, but probably more on a risk-adjusted basis, right? Because the risk of obsolescence or of falling apart was pretty low throughout much of their holding period. So I think that's also something worth taking into account. But also we cannot ignore that it's a hard business, right? I mean, if you see the financial results of Diageo, Pernod lately, I mean, it's a tough business, especially in the high, let's call it high-end categories, because you have to manage the aging, you have to manage your inventory, the inventory that comes with that. So one of the things that I worry about is that if the industry continues to premiumize as they are doing by aging the liquid, what impact that is going to have on cash conversion, right? Because you can see profits go up, but then you're getting a lot of cash tied in into aging inventory. But I think there's a clear trade-off between, hey, what cash conversion do you want, or what durable competitive advantage do you want, and how that will pan out over the next couple of years?
Yeah. But I think it varies a lot between groups, depending on which categories they're in. So if you look at Remy, clearly their inventory days are very high. So I think they would typically be something like 5 to 6 years, because obviously they're, you know, so much of their business is in cognac. And so they're laying down a lot of liquid. If you look at Campari, on the other hand, I think their inventory days would typically be around 1 year. But if you look at most of that is then sort of offset by differences in, you know, other aspects of capital intensity, right? So PP&E and payable days, but also profitability, right? So you would expect a business like Remy, given their higher capital intensity, you know, if you look at sort of economics 101, you would expect higher profitability to, and therefore, you know, somewhat similar returns on capital. And I think that's actually what you're seeing. So I totally get what you're saying. And in fact, historically, if you've looked at the free cash flow yield of a company like Remy, it always looks very, now it's slightly higher on a normalized basis, but it always looks very low. And that's largely because they're consuming so much working capital. But of course, you know, you would, as an investor in the company, you would therefore expect that they're getting a fair return on that capital. And I think historically that's also been the case. So in my view, that they're just, you just need to sort of decide which kind of model you're comfortable investing in, because clearly a company like Remy has much more significant ups and downs, and it requires more capital. But over time, it's also been the underlying growth, I think, has been higher.
Earlier in the show, you heard us talk about the investing platform public.com. That's where you can trade options with no commissions or per contract fees, and you get a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract traded. NerdWallet recently gave Public 5 out of 5 stars for option trading. If you want to see why, go to public.com and start getting a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract traded. Paid for by Public Investing. Options not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures in podcast description. US members only.
That's actually a perfect point for the next topic, which is, I mean, if we look at the main players, we've talked about them throughout the conversation, but we have Diageo, you have Pernod, you have Campari, you have Remy. There are two groups. Let's say one that are the diversified conglomerates, probably Diageo and Pernod are the perfect examples there. Obviously, Campari also have more spirits besides the aperitifs. And Remy is also building a smaller, but also a more diversified spirits portfolio. So what do you think? You talked about some of the upsides and downsides, but what do you think are the main risks, for example, for the concentrated model? I mean, besides the volatility, don't you think that it's dangerous that a category might go through a long down cycle that you said earlier that might be generational? I mean, this is purely, I know that the cognac consumer is probably the Chinese businessman, right? And rappers in the US. That's what I've read about. That's mostly the consumer that you see. But when I see my friends, I mean, none of them has ever drunk cognac. So how do you think that's going to be to evolve over the coming years with younger generations?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. Of course, that's one of the risks of being concentrated. I always think, as an investor, I always think of it in the terms you laid out that, you know, on the one hand, if you want broad exposure to these categories and to the industry, Diageo and Pernod is where you want to start looking, right? Because you're getting the broad exposure, whether it's categories or geographies or price points or But of course, on the other hand, if you have very strong views on a category, so say in the case of cognac, then you want to be invested in Remy, or if bourbon, you want to be invested in Brown-Forman. Yes, you get the volatility in companies like Remy. We're seeing it now, but it's certainly not the first time. You go back to 2013, 14, 15, when they saw that big sort of drawdown in China. You know, revenues were down, I think, organically much less than now. Let's say 10%, EBIT was down 40% or almost halved. You'd never expect to see that from one of the large diversified groups. I think to your point about these very long cycles in the industry, as in, is there a danger if you're invested in a Remy that the next generation, the young of today, will not be drinking cognac? Possibly. I think it's also part of the opportunity that there's this, you know, we can have this sort of hope. I don't know if home bias is the right word, or blindness, where we look at what's going on around us. And
often, no, 100%, because when I looked at Remy and I looked at my environment, obviously things didn't match because Remy was making a lot of money, right? So,
yes. And also, I suspect if you look at your, as you said, your friends, and you know, you might sort of anecdotally think, well, no one here seems to be consuming cognac. But as you said, if you look at, you know, as a matter of fact, the US market, which is super important for them, skews very African American, right? It's an entirely different sort of demographic they're selling to there and in China than if you look at European markets, which are important, but still much less important than the US and China. So I think, and I often see this or hear this when I'm on a conference call or an earnings call or something, and, you know, analysts will look at a business like Heineken and say, or they will sort of imply that it's a commoditized brand. And, but of course, you know, 2/3 of their business is in emerging markets like Vietnam, Nigeria, Mexico, Brazil, where these are hugely aspirational products. So I think that there is always a risk or a tendency to look at the world through the lens that's available to you. I mean, yes, there's certainly a possibility. And in the case of cognac, many people are arguing there could be a structural shift from cognac towards tequila in the US. I think that's too early to say. I can see that argument has some merit, but I think it's too early to say. But I think that sort of home bias, if you want to call it that, often creates opportunities. But sure, I think inevitably that's what you're getting, Leandro. If you're investing in a Remy, for instance, instead of a Pernod or Diageo, you will have to accept that sort of, not just the volatility, but as you say, the long-term uncertainty. Has there been a structural shift here? So far, I'm not convinced there has, of course, because I remain invested. But, you know, that's sort of the price you're paying for the potential upside in a business like that.
And let's jump now to a topic that I think it's probably the most trendy right now, which are the challenges and headwinds, right? The stocks have not been doing great. So obviously everyone's going to start talking about the problems now. When I look, I mean, you said that from IPO, a lot of these companies have outperformed massively. But if we look back, let's say 5-10 years, a lot of these businesses have failed to beat, let's say, an S&P 500, right? They might have beaten European indices. Why do you think this has been the case? Do you think it's related more to the pandemic right now? Or do you think there's something, let's say, structural? Maybe it might be even that less investors are willing to invest in alcohol companies, right? Just for moral reasons or for ESG.
It's always, look, I mean, it's certainly a very current topic because the industry, I think you underplayed it. I mean, it's been horrendous, right? If you look at the last 12, 24 months, certainly post-pandemic, it's been awful. And it's been across the board. Now, more for some than others, Remy especially, but also Campari and the major groups, the large diversified groups. And it's always, you know, it's impossible to say exactly what are the sort of percentages here. But I think on the one hand, you clearly have short-term concerns. So I think it's helpful to look at the short to medium-term challenges, uncertainties, and then the long-term one, because the first group I worry less about, but it's important to understand them because that can create opportunities. The second bucket I care more about. So the short-term ones are clearly things like, you know, post-COVID normalization, and we're really seeing that certainly in the US, and it's certainly in spirits. You see it to some extent in the brewers, but I think you see it less there because naturally, because the shelf life of the product, et cetera, means that the inventory cycle is much less violent and, you know, the adjustments happen much faster. But so that normalization in the US, and it's very difficult to get a really firm grip on where are we in that normalization, right? Because it's difficult to measure inventory levels all along the chain because you have, of course, you have the three-tier distribution and then you have what is called pantry loading, right? Which effectively means people stashing away bottles of bourbon and cognac and what have you at home. So it's difficult to get a very firm grip on that. But clearly, that normalization is one issue. I think consumer spending, the health of the consumer is another one. Now I'm talking about the sort of cyclical or short to medium term challenges, not least because many of these companies put through a lot of significant price increases, right, in 22, 23. So some would argue we're seeing the sort of impact of those price increases on consumption now. And in fact, I think last year, US total alcohol per capita spending was down something like 4.5%, 4 to 5%, which is very unusual. And I think really that was the kind of data point that really alarmed a lot of investors. You know, is this a temporary issue or has something structurally changed? Part of that, of course, is the inventory adjustments. So across the board, but especially in categories like cognac and some other categories, you've seen very violent inventory destocking, right? And it's too early to say if we're sort of at the end of that, but certainly what I'm hearing from these companies now, Remy, for instance, is that inventory levels are very low and, you know, any recovery you see in underlying consumption will very quickly lead to a reversal there. But so yeah, you have all of these, right? You have the normalization, you have the inventory cycle, you have the health of the consumer.
Mm-hmm. And I think that this talking argument makes quite a bit of sense, right? Because spirits is not the only industry that's being impacted by this. I mean, a lot of industries post-pandemic are being impacted by the fact that their consumer was ordering more thinking that it was going to be sustainable or maybe due to fears of not having supply in the future due to another COVID wave. And I think that makes it somewhat believable, right? Because it's not only happening in spirits.
No, I agree. But of course, even if you adjust for that, so that decline in per capita consumption, even if you adjust for inventory sort of fluctuations, yes, there we probably have seen a slight decline in per capita consumption and I'm looking at the US because it's such a significant market. Mm-hmm. But of course, you have a couple other factors that we sort of touched on that may at least explain some of that decline, right? And then you have potential short to medium term issues like tariffs in the US and China. I mean, they're very difficult to, you know, we can look at what the exposure is depending on, you know, how much you sell to these markets and how much you produce in these markets. So like for the brewers, for instance, I think it's less of an issue because they have a lot of in-market production. But whereas if you look at, say, Remy or Campari, it's more of a challenge. Mm-hmm. The longer term, you know, I would spend more time thinking about the longer term challenges. And so these would be regulation on the one hand, but I think especially changing consumer behaviors. Right. And I think it seems like the one topic that most investors worry about is declining consumption, especially among younger cohorts. Right. And there, I think.
And there you can include also, for example, weight loss drugs, right? And the impact that they can have on alcohol consumption.
Yeah. And of course, you know, the boring answer is it's too early to say, but I think you can make some, at least you can sort of make an informed guess here. And certainly, interestingly, when you look at survey data in the US, where I think this topic is especially sort of hot, the survey data so far at least seems to suggest that underage drinking is in decline, which is a good thing. I think most people certainly in the industry would argue, but that most consumers, certainly if you look at current cohorts of, I think this would be for 22-year-olds and up, coming into working age, consume similar levels to previous cohorts of 22-year-olds. And so, you know, we can't entirely sort of rely on that for comfort here, but I think it's an interesting nuance, right? Because I think it is right to say that young or very young consumers are drinking less, but I think it's equally right to say that it doesn't seem that once people reach working age, that they drink less. And in fact, you also see some data to suggest, I say some because there's lots of surveys on this and they sometimes show somewhat different sort of statistics, but there's also some evidence to suggest that some older cohorts consume slightly more. If you look at total consumption levels, LPA in the US, and actually if you look at the European market like the UK, they are in fact, they are down from 1 or 2 years ago, but they are up from 10 years ago. So I think, you know, who knows where we are in 5 or 10 years, but I think it's too simplistic to say that people are drinking less. I mean, it's
right. There's not a long-term trend right now where you can base off that comment. You have some short-term noise that maybe makes you think that it might happen, but you don't need like 10 years of data that suggests it.
No, exactly. And I, you know, I'm the first to admit this may very well be the early stages of a structural decline in alcohol consumption. So I'm not denying that possibility, but I'm saying the data so far doesn't necessarily suggest that. So that, I think that's one part of it. The other part of that sort of argument is, you know, that's looking at developed markets. But if you look at emerging markets, it's a very different picture, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at major markets like China, I mean, India isn't necessarily so significant yet, but I think it could very well become significant. But if you look at most emerging markets, you're still seeing very significant volume growth and increases in per capita consumption. So I think, you know, I think it's slightly unfair to say people drink less. Well, one, you're probably referring to developed markets like Western Europe and the US, and two, that it isn't even necessarily true in those markets. I think it's, you know, it certainly increases the level of uncertainty or the sort of potential risk or perceived risk here. But I think looking at the data, it's not so clear. And then thirdly, so we've talked about, you know, volumes in developed and emerging markets. So that's two pieces of it. But then thirdly, of course, there's the sort of value part of the equation, price and mix. And of course, that's been a positive contribution, even in markets like the US. I think if you look at the decade between the financial crisis and the pandemic, you had something like a 2% contribution from those, mainly from mix in that decade. And of course, that 1.5% or something that came from mix is what the industry refers to as premiumization. And, you know, we've been talking about premiumization for decades, but I think at the moment there's a lot of noise in the data, but until recently, at least, that trend has been intact, and I would like to think that will continue to be a driver. So, you know, I'm not arguing these are high single digit growth businesses, and I don't know, it could be that this is the beginning of a structural change, but I don't think the picture is nearly as dire as many would argue.
And probably one argument here is that if indeed we are in a structural decline, then alcohol or spirits business are going to transition towards, like, let's say, like tobacco companies, right? What tobacco companies have done. What do you think happens in that scenario? Because when I look at valuations across the sector, I think to an extent, they obviously don't trade like if it was in a terminal decline, but I think in the valuations you can see sort of some doubt about the market of this being structural, right? And these companies being more in the tobacco scenario than in a short-term downswing. So one of the, let's say, successes from tobacco industries is that tobacco companies is that they have allocated capital very well while they were going down. I struggle to see that in spirits companies, in many of them, to be honest, especially in what they do with the free cash. What do you think happens if we transition to a tobacco-like scenario?
I mean, in some way, it's a great question. And in some ways, Leandro, I wish, you know, we could see a sort of rerun of what some of the tobacco companies have done. Because interestingly, you look at a company like BAT, for instance, you know, for decades, there was very little or hardly any top-line growth, but shareholder returns have been incredible, at least if you going back a few years. And that's partly on the back of, you know, efficiencies and higher margins, but it's largely on the back of very consistent share buybacks, right? So I think it is interesting that, you know, we can argue back and forth about, will these companies still be growing at, say, 4 or 5 or 6% organically? Hopefully. But even if they don't, there's at least a possibility that they can create shareholder value by buying back stock, right? And especially if you look at where most of these companies are trading at the moment, right? So, you know, Diageo and Pernod are trading maybe in the sort of mid-teens or thereabouts. You know, Remy and Campari, high teens to low 20s. You know, if you believe that those are attractive valuations, then they can create a lot of value here. I think one of the challenges is that, and you alluded to this, that I think in the tobacco industry, it was so clear to everyone because of regulation and everything else that these companies can and shouldn't chase growth, right? I think the challenge in some ways is that the mindset in the spirits industry is still very much that it's a growth business, or that's the mindset of the people who run these companies. And hopefully it is. But I think that's the difficulty when it comes to share buybacks. Or one of the difficulties, because if the mindset is that it's still a growth business, these companies will still spend on capacity expansions and acquisitions. And the other challenge I see in terms of share buybacks is the ownership structure. So Diageo is an exception because they've bought back, I think, about a third of outstanding stock in the last 2 decades or just over 2 decades, which is very significant. But of course, if you look at the likes of Remy, Campari, Pernod, their family controlled effectively, right? And so there's other considerations there. You know, they may not want to reduce the free float, or they may not want to increase their ownership to a level where they trigger various sort of mechanisms. And thirdly, you have the issue of debt. So I think some of these companies are restricted in the amount of share buybacks they can do by the fact that they're already at the sort of towards the higher end of their leverage ratios. So I agree with you. I think the opportunity is there. I can see the case.
Which is, I think that's also another important point, right? Because these companies that some of them are quite levered, at the same time, a lot of their debt is fixed rate, but they also have variable rate debt. And obviously now they are going through a down cycle together with like the highest interest rates we've seen in a decade, right? And I mean, I think I'm not the one here who's going to predict the movement of interest rates, but right? But I think there's sort of a reasonable expectation that if interest rates move somewhere, it'll be lower more than higher, right? So I think that's also a point because, I mean, the interest expense for Diageo is quite significant. I don't know if it's maybe 1/3 of operating cash flow or something like that.
Yes. Yeah, I can't remember what that number is exactly, but yeah, my frustration is also that these companies don't buy back shares countercyclically in the way that you would like to see, right? Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, like most large, you know, like most large listed corporations where you haven't got a sort of founder manager, they tend to buy back shares when the share price is high, and they tend to, well, I shouldn't say issue equity because they haven't really for a very long time. But what I would say from a capital cycle point of view is that, which I think is interesting because we've talked about the demand side of things, right? What's the potential organic growth of these businesses? But if you apply the capital cycle sort of mindset, then I think it is interesting because this is an industry where you look at the large listed groups, at least, capital is coming out. It's not going in, right? So certainly if you go back to 15 years to, you know, just before the great financial crisis, it was a different picture. There were some very large deals. There was equity issuance. If you look at what Diageo and others have been doing, but I think Diageo may be the best example in more recent years, is they haven't been issuing equity. They've been buying back a lot of stock. So clearly, on some level, capacity is coming out of this industry, and that sometimes is a very good sign.
Yeah. And one of the things that surprised me, well, not surprised me, but I thought was interesting, that when I was looking at Diageo, I mean, Debra Crew, the current CEO, she comes from the tobacco industry. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think that's coincidental. The head of Europe, the head of Diageo Europe, also came from the tobacco industry. In fact, she has gone back to, I think she went back to BAT. So I think these companies are aware of what might happen, or maybe the challenges that they might face. Even if you don't have regulation against you, you probably have publicity against you, right? The population against you, because they think that you are sort of comparable to tobacco. So I think that's also interesting. I think the spirits companies are well aware of what they have to do to avoid being in that scenario. But when I look at the current valuations, I don't think that the market is assuming a lot of growth. So yeah. I think that's also an upside someone could get, right? Because if this is a growth industry again, then obviously I don't think that they are going to stay where they are. But it's also reasonable to have doubts because it's very tough to untangle the short-term noise and the long-term structural problems that might come.
I agree. The market may be right. And what I find difficult with the industry currently, well, it's always the case, isn't it? But maybe especially now is that the kind of questions that I need answers to have confidence, there are no answers to you. It's not just that I don't have them. No one has them, not even the people who run these businesses. You know, will consumers be drinking less on average 10 years from now? Will the young be drinking less? What will be the impact of weight loss drugs? You know, what will be the substitution when we look at things like cannabis? But these aren't just difficult questions. They're unknowables in some way. So you know, that's why, one, we own a few of these and they account for, you know, we have a lot of exposure, but it's still, I think, 20% of the portfolio. So, you know, even if I think it's potentially very attractive, I'm the first to admit that this could be the beginning of change and we have to sort of position for that. But of course, on balance, you know, my conclusion has been that I think it's potentially very interesting. I think the tobacco parallel is interesting, although I don't think the industry is quite there in terms of the mindset and the culture and perhaps they shouldn't be. I think it's too early because that's sort of, you know, you have to capitulate before you get to the point where you say the only thing we can do is buy back shares. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they should be doing that. And I don't think they are. I'd like to think you're right about the agile management. I have to say so far, it's been very disappointing, not necessarily mm-hmm. the way they run the business, because some of that I think has been sort of simmering for a while, but the way they communicate with the market, but that's getting into company specifics, but it certainly speaks to governance and sort of mismanagement, which I think is, maybe we'll get back to that, but I think is another sort
of issue. I think it's an interesting point. I mean, if you look at Diageo and you see what has happened over the past, let's say, year and a half or past year, I could sense some kind of we're losing control in the management's tone and communication, right? I mean, it's not normal for a company to get a surprise in Latin America to the point that you have to say, yeah, sales are not going to grow, they're going to drop 20%. I mean, it's not like you're saying they're not going to grow 5%, they're going to grow 3%. It's actually a very significant change. And maybe one expects that to happen to a smaller company, right? Because governance is not as good, or maybe they don't even have to justify like to the market what they are going to do. But in a company like Diageo, that seems pretty strange.
Yeah. One of my concerns is that, you know, they were knowingly overearning now this is just me speculating, but that they were knowingly overearning in some of these markets for a long time. And we've seen this in other companies. I think Estee Lauder is a good example, and there's others. And, you know, if that's the case, obviously there's an issue, there's mismanagement. And if that isn't the case, then there's been poor communication and lack of oversight from group management. So one way or another, that's a concern or a frustration I have with a business like Diageo. I think more generally, governance and management, you know, in addition to all the sort of external risks we've talked about, that would probably be the one I worry about. So partly because of what we've seen at Diageo, but also we've had succession events, management succession at, you know, we've had it at Campari, for instance. We've obviously had it at Diageo. Remy, it's been 3 or 4 years now. But so we have a new, younger sort of group of CEOs running these businesses, with some pretty big shoes to fill. And so far, it's not entirely encouraging, I have to say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would like to believe that the fact that most of these are family controlled would enable them to take the long-term view. But I have to say, on the whole, I don't think they're nearly as well managed as they could be. And I don't think they're nearly as well managed as, for instance, some of the luxury groups, which I think are sort of role models in the way they, you know, think long-term and invest up front. And I don't feel I see that even with the family controlled businesses in this space. And certainly when I look at, you know, groups like Diageo, they're quite anxious. They emphasize, you know, focus groups and what was the consumer looking for, and right, It's a very different model from, and there's very little true innovation in these businesses, right? When you compare this to the likes of, you know, some of the luxury groups, which I think are much more offer driven, as they would say, right? They come up with the product or the service or the experience, and they offer this to the market. Marketing is there to sort of communicate the message. I think this is much more of a traditional FMCG model, right? Mm-hmm. For good and bad. But I think one of the issues is that you see very little true innovation. And I think that's a real concern for some of these groups.
Mm-hmm. I think right now I just remembered talking about the bad communication of these companies when Diageo's CFO said that there will be no margin expansion over the medium term, but if inflation cools down faster, then the long term will be the medium term. And I was like, no, but I mean, you cannot say this, because the analysts were like, so what's the long term? What's the medium term? And she said, like, well, if inflation comes down faster, then we'll get to the long term faster. And I'm like, yeah, but that makes no sense. I mean, the long term is the long term and the medium term is the medium term. You can simply say, hey, it's going to be tough. We don't have a view on inflation over the next 3 years. If inflation does not abate, we are not going to expand margins. If inflation comes down, we are going to be able to do that. When that happens, we don't know. I don't know. I feel that the communication should be much more straightforward and maybe also less communication and more proving, right? Because seeing a lot of, hey, we're going to do this. Yeah, but that doesn't come. So obviously investors get worried.
I agree. In fact, to your last point, I would also prefer most of these companies to talk less about financial targets. And so once again, if you look at the luxury groups, and now that they have the, you know, no pun intended, but luxury of actually not having to communicate targets because of the family control. And but so do many companies in this industry. I can, on some level, I can understand why Diageo does, because they're run by a sort of hired management team, and you know, it's a very open shareholder structure.
Much more corporate.
It is. I mean, it's somewhat unfortunate, but still. But I look at companies like Remy. I don't fully understand why they put all these long-term financial targets out there. I don't understand why they, in some way, you know, they're restricting themselves by saying we're going
to end your
margin level 10 years out. That doesn't make much sense to me. But so I think governance is also a concern here.
I'm all up for no guidance, but at the same time, I think that works great in proven management teams.
Yeah.
In not so proven management teams, it can be very dangerous, right? Yeah. I mean, if Hermes says we're going to grow at an attractive growth rate, well, yeah, you believe them. They've been saying that forever, and they've managed the business even above expectations. But when you see a company underperforming, then I understand that investors say, okay, but what's your measuring stick, right? And somewhat you can infer those when you look at the compensation structure and everything, which is also another topic. But yeah, I think obviously these businesses have to prove themselves, right? And the market has given its opinion, which is, okay, prove yourself and then we'll see. And before it was more like, this is a good business. You don't need to be proven.
It's a very dramatic shift, isn't it, in perception? Because if you go back 7 or 10 years, these were the kind of companies that certainly European quality-minded buy and hold investors wanted to hold. They were some of the most attractive out there. And, you know, I would actually argue that now there's a real crisis of confidence or trust here, you know, partly to do with external factors and partly to do with execution in these companies.
I mean, I think it's more or less how the market works, right? When everything's going bad, then you get the double whammy of the bad results, and then you get the bad market perception. And when everything is going right, then you can get the benefit of both. And that's exactly why I don't think, I mean, in many cases, that's where the opportunity for a long-term investor lies, right? Because if a company that goes through short-term problem, the market would identify it as always short-term, then multiples would stay high probably.
Yeah. Agreed. Agreed. Hopefully it's an opportunity. I'd like to believe so.
Thank you very much, Christian, for your time. I think it was a great conversation on a very timely topic. So,
well, thank you. Pleasure to speak again, Leandro.